Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Long, sad times, go long, bad times, we are rid of you at last. Howdy, gay times, cloudy gray times.
From all of us here at the Tom Hartman Program, a very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Tom Hartman here. Just keep on listening. The great Barbra Streisand. It's Barbra Streisand. I know that she had planned on, hoped to sing that at the inauguration or after the victory of either John Kerry or Al Gore. I forget which one. I think it might have been John Kerry. And so I just, in tribute to Barack Obama's extraordinary accomplishment last night and Barbra Streisand's extraordinary accomplishment of her life, I wanted to open the show with that. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and wow, what a night. I got an email this morning from Patricia Viejas, who my travel agent down in Lima, Peru, who helped put that trip together. And I want to, first of all, before our American callers start calling in, because we're going to take a lot of calls today, Bernie Sanders is going to drop by in our second hour, and Mark Thompson is going to be here in a few minutes. But I would like to invite our international callers. And if you're calling from inside the United States, hold off for a few minutes, please. Just pause for 5 or 10 minutes and don't call in if you're calling from inside the United States, because I'd love to hear from people outside the United States. And our telephone number, 866-303-2270. Most people internationally can call an 866 number, 866-303-2270. And Lauren or Chris, do you happen to know what that what the 212 number is that drops in on? You're not sure. Okay, but the 866 number should work. 866-303-2270. If you're calling from outside the United States, give us a shout. We'd love to hear your thoughts. This is the note that I got from Patricia. The woman who put together this trip to Lima, Peru. She says, congratulations for the election of Obama as President of the United States of America. We're very happy for that. You know that all your country does has a worldwide impact. This is a big change for you. I will pray that he will be the same person, Barack Obama, of course, and that he will run your country very wisely. I think the world has seen the kind of campaign that was run by Barack Obama, and the world is saying, you know, this guy, I mean, it's just all around the world. People are saying, you know, this guy could work. This guy could make it. This is the guy that could bring this country together. And it is an extraordinary day. I remember so vividly 4 years ago this day on this radio show doing suicide counseling and feeling it myself. I mean, just the intense despair. It was just extraordinary. So 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And first, I'd like to pick up some of our out-of-the-United-States callers. So if you're in the United States, I'll be picking up your calls at the bottom of the hour, and we'll carry them through the next 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Vaughn in Nova Scotia, Canada. Hey, Vaughn, your thoughts on our election here in the United States?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Very well, thank you.
Listen to you every day. Love your show, man.
Thank you.
First time I called in.
So what are your thoughts on the election of Barack Obama, and what do you think that Nova Scotians and Canadians are? So what are they saying today?
It's incredible. I mean, I think the first, we just went through an election ourselves, as you know, and I think there was more people here in Canada knew more about the U.S. election than the policies and everything than they did about Canada. I know I followed it every day, and I think he's an incredible person. Like, he inspires people, and, you know, listening to the radio this morning, a lot of people were talking about the issue that it's the first black president, and yes, that's a great accomplishment, but I think he's so much more than that.
Yeah.
You know, I think he changed politics, you know, running a good campaign and not being dirty and just being a good all-around person and inspiring so many people. I think he just changed the world.
I absolutely agree. Vaughn, thank you so much for the call from Nova Scotia. Appreciate it. Jackie in Switzerland. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. How is Switzerland?
I am so excited. I haven't slept. I stayed up the whole night and watched. I'm proud, finally, of our country again.
Uh-huh.
And
you're an American expat living in Switzerland, I assume.
Right. And I have not met one person here who was for McCain and Palin. So I can kind of show my face again, not to be embarrassed about our politics. I'm hoping that Barack can pull it through for us. I have some confidence in him. I just thought he was so courageous.
Yes.
And it's such a deeply profound moment in our history.
I think it is absolutely extraordinary. Jackie, thank you so much for the call.
Thanks for everything you do.
You're welcome, and thanks for listening to the show there in Switzerland. Guy in England, in the United Kingdom. Hey, Guy, welcome.
Hello there. Yeah, I love your show. It's great. I listen to it quite a lot.
Thank you, Guy.
Yesterday, with the election, stayed up late, and that was fantastic. And absolutely, you know, delighted. First person I saw was someone living in my house. She's some French Senegalese, and we embraced. It was lovely.
That's marvelous. That is marvelous. So the, you know, it's midday now in the UK, right?
No, it's the evening now. It's just gone dark.
Evening. So you know, any you know, how are people in the streets? Is there any kind of you know, celebration?
I haven't actually been out, to be honest, today.
Okay.
I've been in all day. I've been nursing a hangover.
Great. All righty. Guy, thank you so much. Great. I appreciate the call. I got to move along.
Well, once again, I love your show. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you for listening to us there in the UK. Gene in Manchester in the United Kingdom. Hey, Gene.
Hi, it's Jean, not Gene.
Oh, Jean. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Hello, Jean.
J-E-A-N.
Yes. And welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Thank you.
How is Manchester, UK, Manchester, England, responding to the election of Barack Obama?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's a big thing. I'm originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I've been living here for 10 years. It's not just, the whole news, everybody's happy, and we didn't sleep. Mm. We were waiting. I got to sleep 5 o'clock this morning.
Oh,
and, you know, just waiting for the outcome. I mean, it's really, I would like to congratulate all the American people for really deciding on this change that we all need. You know, everything that happens in the USA has an impact on the rest of the world, especially my country where I come from.
Yes.
In the so-called Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's a lot of trouble at the moment, and the hope of people, they have family back over there, and people are celebrating in the Congo as well. Their feeling is that once Barack Obama comes into power, things are going to change in the Congo and everywhere else.
And the Congo is experiencing Democratic Republic of Congo is experiencing a very, very difficult time now. 4 million people, I think, so far killed in that war over the years. Jean, thank you so much for the call. I've got to move along, but I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much for calling in and for listening to the show. Dan in London. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. Your thoughts on the election?
Up till 4, you know, actually it was up to 6 in the morning over here, just watching. I couldn't believe it, but just so excited. And I really felt that I was that I wanted to be back in the States for this. You know, it was kind of felt kind of lonely over here. But today I went up to pick up some milk up at the store, and you know, little delicatessen type thing, and it's all over the newspapers, and the people inside were so thrilled.
That's great.
All around London since about August, I've been seeing Obama shirts left and right. So I don't know if they're, you know, UK residents or just visiting, but it's a pretty good vibe over here.
That is great to hear. Dan, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We've got calls on the board from Kenya, from Honduras, from Saskatchewan, from Montreal, from London. We will be picking up more of your calls, plus Mark Thompson's going to drop by and say hi. We'll pick up a couple of calls with Mark, and then we'll be getting to calls from the United States. I just wanted to hear what the rest of the world had to say as well. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
United States. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been taking international calls all morning from all over the world. And Mark Thompson, by the way, a talk show host on Sirius Satellite Radio. I've been on his show a number of times. I was on with him last night. Mark, first of all, I just want to welcome you to the show. Mark,
thank you.
Hey,
thank you. Thank you for having me, man.
Great
it's
to have you with
to
us.
Here, Tom.
And I'd like to get into a conversation with you about what happened. But first, I want to pick up a couple of calls. Will you take some calls with me?
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Here we have James calling from Kenya. Hey, James, you're on the air with Tom and Mark Thompson.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Very good. How is Kenya responding to the election of Barack Obama?
Oh, Kenya is great. It's actually been declared a national holiday tomorrow.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah, so we're so proud. I'm so proud a black man has finally made it. I've been reading about the civil rights and everything, and it's about time. It's about time. I'm so happy.
So how is it being handled in the city? What part of Kenya are you in?
Nairobi.
Nairobi, okay.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. But everyone is all happy and drinking, celebrating, singing.
That's
so
great.
It's a good time.
That's great. I was in Nairobi in March. It's a beautiful city. Thank you very much, James. Appreciate
well,
it. Well,
I like the show.
Thank
That's
you, Mark.
Something. That's
yeah.
something. That really is something.
It is. It really is.
I'm still pretty much speechless even to, you know, to hear that and hear people call in from Kenya. I mean, this is not just a United States election. I mean, this was a world event.
Yeah.
And it's gonna, you know, America is still, for whatever reason, I know time, people like you and I are here to hold things accountable, but, America is still by many considered to be the greatest country in the world. And, to get that kind of call from Kenya, to know the inspiration that this is to Africans throughout the world, the diaspora, other people of color, and really just internationally and in the European countries even, this is really something incredible.
We had three calls from the UK. We've had nothing but – I asked for international calls this morning, and I've got on the board right now calls from Honduras, from Canada, from Puerto Rico, from Germany.
Wow.
And we will be picking up those calls as we continue. Mark, very quickly, though, you told me a story last night, and I'd like to kind of bookend this because I have a story from 30 years ago. You have a story from yesterday, and I think that they are perfect bookends. My story from 30 years ago was when I was a young man, the girl who lived next door to us, who was about my age, wanted to marry an African-American man. She was white. Her father, and I may have told you this story, I don't know. Her father not only disowned, you know, wouldn't even go to the wedding. My father told her that he would walk her down the aisle, and did. And that family next door lived next door to us for another 5 or 6 years, and never again spoke to our family. That was 30 years ago. That was the state of race relations 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Yesterday, you had an experience with your son.
Yeah. My son is six, and I took him in the voting booth with me, and he walked in with me. We got our paper ballot, and we, in Washington, D.C., we used the we connect the line. It's a straight line. You connect an arrow, I should say. And I gave him the pencil, and I stood over him, told him what to connect. And, of course, he didn't have to ask about Barack Obama. That's the first time he'd done that. My son at six voted with me for the first time for the first African-American president. And it just the sense of meaning that has. Your experience 30 years ago, this one, all this has been about, and all racism and race relations was about, was whether or not African Americans and by extension other people of color are human beings. That's the crux of it. Whether we were three-fifths human or whether we were full human beings, even in the Constitution. And what happened on yesterday now pretty much erases any notion that people who look like me or my son, people of color, are less than human. People like you, Tom, who've never practiced racism, whether or not you're human, all of us are human now. We, you know, imagining what your family must have gone through during that period. We know what that was like. But America took an enormous leap forward last night. Of course, there are things that still need to be done. You know there it's so institutionalized. You know, this generation, even younger than us, doesn't feel it or see it as much. But there are remnants of it, vestiges of it that still exist that we really take for granted. And now what has to happen, people like you and me, as exhilarating as this moment is, must remind people that there are still some who are left behind. There are still some who are holding the fort, waiting on us to arrive to liberate them. Once we do that, we'll be home free.
Yeah, not just all over the world, but here in the United States as well, Mark Thompson.
Yeah, yeah.
It really is true. We have about a half a minute here. Mark Thompson, your hours on Sirius Satellite Radio.
5 to 8 Eastern, Sirius Left 146.
There you go, Sirius Left 140. We're on the air right now, as a matter of fact. And final thoughts on the election, Mark?
Well, you know, now it's the beginning of a new era. We'll see what happens. I think we're going to see, as creative and innovative as this campaign was, I think we'll see that much creativity and innovation in a new government. It's going to be exciting. We'll probably have to put on, guys like you and I, have to put on a different pair of glasses to analyze it now, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that our work has not ended today. It has begun.
No. No, Tom, I respect you. We need you, man. You keep up the good work, too, okay?
You too, Mark. Mark Thompson from Sirius Satellite Radio. Thank you, Mark.
Take care, buddy.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your phone calls right on the other side of this break. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room.
You're listening to the best of Tom Hartmann.
Of individuals or a collection of red states and blue states, we are and always will be the United States of America.
So well. Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. Sue in the chat room, which is really filling up. You get there over at TomHartmann.com. You can see our live streaming free video over at AirAmerica.com. Anyhow, our chat room, she's got a new graphic in there of fireworks going off. It's great. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, taking calls from all around the world. Brad in Mainz, Germany. Hey, Brad, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Mainz, Germany.
And, Mainz, Germany, I'm sorry.
I stayed up last night to watch it on CNN and woke up about 4 o'clock and thought, well, they had a commercial. I'd just look and see. Three German stations, Erste Deutsche Fernsehen, Zweite and West Deutsche Rundfunk, all of them are carrying the election live in the middle of the, it's like 3:30 or 4 in the morning.
That's crazy.
And Bush was here. He visited Schroeder here back, two, three years ago, before Angela Merkel came in. And they literally shut down the town of Mainz, including even moving a lady out of her apartment who was 200 meters or so from where Bush was going to be because she had an anti-Bush sticker or something on her door, made the papers here. And people from Mainz, you know, all the businesses had to shut down. And basically my son and I walked down there, and there was nobody down to see him. And I think, boy, if there's one thing Obama could do right now, or as soon as possible, for he's got to get a transition team in there and get all the embedded politicals that get embedded down in the government, down in the agency levels out. I'm an ex-government employee, and that's mistake Clinton made.
He won't be able to start doing that legally until after January 21st, but
you've
got to get ready.
When the Republicans used to come in, they are almost on the very next day, the people that were there got letters, and within a month, they had people sitting in the positions, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Well, the Democrats never did that. But
essentially
the Germans are happy, and I've been congratulated all over town. As if, you know, as if I had something to do with it. Okay. And I just, you know.
Well, good on you, Brad. Brad, I got to move along, but thanks so much for the call from Mainz.
Okay, Tom, ich wünsche dir einen schönen Abend noch, gell?
Vielen Dank, und Ihnen auch. Wilbert in Honduras. Hey, Wilbert, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. How you doing today?
Great. How is Honduras responding to the election of
I could tell you right now, you know, there is no word to describe, you know, these people here, my family and, you know, several families from this little town where I'm from, fireworks and all the stuff because, you know, we feel that, you know, after 30 years, you know, since we got in this bad situation in little countries like Honduras, we finally feel like we're gonna have a break, you know. And telling you, when things go bad, and you know, in the States, my people starve, you know. And you should know better than me, you know, because you're a smart man. And you know, I really appreciate the job that you do. I've been listening to you for quite a long time. And I want to tell you that you, my school, you know, even my my English, I got better, you know, and I have no words and no money, you know, to pay you, you know, for all the things that you do. And congratulations for
thank you, Wilbert.
Obama. You
and what's, what city in Honduras do you live in?
I'm from the north coast of Honduras, you know, by the Atlantic.
By the Atlantic, okay. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Wilbert. I've got to move along. I appreciate the call. Thank you so much.
God bless you, Tom.
Thank you, and you too, Wilbert. Great to hear from you. Robert in Puerto Rico. Hey, Robert.
Yeah, hi. Thrilled beyond words. Most of the people I know are just ecstatic. Of course, we had our own elections here that didn't have anything to do with the U.S., so there was a lot of activity having to do with those elections. And for reasons that are very local to Puerto Rico, having to do with the incumbent who had some charges of corruption, the conservative won, unfortunately. But I don't think that reflects the general consensus about Obama. But the people I know are thrilled beyond words. One thing I wanted to share with you is my perception of my from a personal point of view of what this means to young people, because I have a 15-year-old son, and I've been politically involved or talking about politics with him all our life. And for the last 8 years, the most mature years of his life, the only America he has known has been this America that performed torture, had all these inhumane things going on. It was just an awful America. And this morning when he left, you know, he walked out and said, the first thing he said to me just before he left for school was, you know, maybe there's hope for America after all. Maybe, you know, the Americans aren't so stupid as I thought they were. So, you know, it's a great day, and I just can't tell you how thrilled everybody I know is.
Great. Robert, thank you so much for the report from Puerto Rico. We're great to hear from you. Merrill in La Huaca, Mexico? Merrill?
La Huaca.
Okay, great. Thank you for calling.
Well, I want to thank you. You're a great educator, and you should be required listening for all Americans every morning.
Thank you. How is Mexico responding to this election?
Well, I'm in a small village. I'm getting feedback here. Let me try to change this. Okay, are you still there?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm in a small village outside of Oaxaca called Teotihuacan, and I can't stop crying, so excuse me.
That's okay.
People here are waving little American flags. It's incredible. Everybody is so happy. We're weeping together. We're laughing together. We're celebrating together. I was in Grant Park 40 years ago under very different circumstances. And I watched last night the faces of all those people. And everybody was crying and hugging and celebrating. And I believe that I have carried this pain in my heart for 40 years, and it is finally released. And it's a collective pain that has been felt all over the world. And we are looking at such an incredible transitional moment. It's a change of consciousness, and we can release the pain that we've been feeling and move forward as a total people. But we have to support Obama. And this is the thing that is so necessary, is that now we've got someone who has a vision that embodies the hope and the belief of what America can be. And we've got to support this man, because the challenge that he faces is so daunting. But yep, we can all celebrate. And now, finally, after 9/11, we are all Americans again. So.
Yeah, well, as the famous headline of Le Monde. Merrill, thank you so much for calling, and thank you so much for listening to us in La Oaxaca, Mexico.
Oaxaca, and I'm looking forward to coming home.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Liam in Dublin, Ireland. Hey, Liam, thank you for calling.
How you doing, Tom? Well, Tom, the world is a safer place today.
Yes.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. And I just want to say a few things about in the early part of our country, we had people called Quislings. They sold out their own to the English. Sean Hannity is a Quisling. He sold out Americans to corporate America, and he's an absolute disgrace. And as for our other idiot, Bill O'Reilly, what a jackass he is. I'm so thrilled. You couldn't believe how happy I am and everybody around me. You have a great day. And, Tom, I'm a big fan. Thank God for guys like you.
Well, thank you, Liam. And to put a fine point on it, we beat Bill O'Reilly in the Los Angeles ratings almost 2-1. And Hannity, you know, yeah, you're right. He just got a $200 million contract. He does the bidding of corporate America. But I think Americans are waking up to that, and they're moving in the right direction. Liam, thanks so much for listening to us in Dublin, Ireland. Thanks for the call.
This is a great day. Thank you.
Great to hear from you. Kent in Paris, France. Hey, Kent, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's amazing being an American living overseas, especially for the past 7 years, and feeling in the space of 24 hours the difference. It's like a weight coming off. Maybe that's just internal and it's just me, but people are in the streets. I live in a very heavily African immigrant populated area, and these guys, a lot of them aren't even French. They literally are from Ivory Coast or whatnot, wearing Obama shirts for the past week, yelling Obama in the street. It's been going all day.
Really?
Yeah, chanting Obama, just breaks out spontaneously, and then it calms down, and it happens again, and they have, I don't even know where they get these things, but, you know, like Obama's little ski caps and stocking caps and shirts and Obama 2008, and it's fantastic. And Paris kind of went a little crazy last night. There were big events, Americans meeting, and I agree with, you know, what that previous, the female caller, just a couple calls back said. It's just amazing, and it really feels like America is going to be able to be that beacon on the hill again in the eyes of Americans, hopefully, and in the foreign relations.
So well said. Ken, thanks so much for listening to us there in Paris, France, and thanks for the call. And yes, we're all Americans now, and we're all citizens of the world. Maybe that's a better way to say it, because it, you know, it's, we're all humans here. We're all alive. We're all part of the same game. And now we need to work toward enhancing the quality of life all over the world.
This is the best of the Tom Hartman Program.
May have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. And to those Americans whose support I have yet to earn, I may not have won your vote tonight, but I hear your voices. I need your help, and I will be your president too.
There you go. Carol in Brussels, Belgium. Thank you for calling, Carol.
It's good to talk to you. You're a wonderful beacon for all of us who are overseas, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Carol. I'm beginning to think not only are we the number one progressive talk show host or talk show in America, but we must be the number one internationally. We're getting nothing but it's wonderful. So, Carol, how is Belgium responding to the election of Barack Obama?
Just as you are hearing from the other countries in Europe, it is amazing that they give much more time here to the election, to this election, than I've ever seen them give to a Belgian election. You see, they've caught, the European Union has kind of caught the corporatist flu.
Right.
And they are beginning to privatize and to talk about,
ever since Thatcher.
And it's a good idea now that perhaps Obama can give a different image, and they'll catch that one too.
That's marvelous. Carol, thanks so much for calling and for listening to us in Brussels, Belgium.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Sue from Milton Keynes, England. Sue, who runs our chat room. You can drop in and say hi. Hey, Sue.
Hi, Tom. Congratulations, America.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. How Milton Keynes is a, would you call it a suburb of London? I've been there.
No, it's a brand new town. It's separate. But it's about 60 miles away from London.
60 miles, okay. It's hard to remember. It's been a few years since I've been there. But in any case, so how is the UK? What are you seeing in UK media, Sue?
Well, everyone seems pretty excited. It's like a big weight off of the world's shoulders.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just, for African Americans. It's also about relationships around the world, you know, with Bush being so, it's our way or... Or the highway.
Yeah, there's almost.
We feel we can carry on with life again.
Yep, like Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sue, thanks so much for the call, and thank you very much, and thanks for the great work you're doing in our chat room. If you want to drop
in
and say hi. Sue runs the show there. She has her daily stack every day on our website at tomhartman.com. She compiles what's going on in the show. Sue, you're wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. Jan in Saskatchewan, Canada. Hey, Jan.
Well, my wife is in Saskatchewan. She's American. I'm Canadian. I'm a long hauler. I'm in Missouri at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I was dog tired last night. I could barely stay awake, but I would not stop listening to your guest, Mr. Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was in tears. I would call her every 15 minutes with results. And we would discuss them. We were both in tears. We moved to Canada. We've been married 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, I came to her home in Iowa, and I was informed she was ashamed to be an American anymore.
Mm.
We moved to Canada. Last night, when I told her it was the game was up, the power of one had come through with shining colors. And she said, you know, I'm holding my head high.
Yeah. That's a wonderful thing.
Both of us in tears, even still. What it means to your country and to the planet is just absolutely beyond measure.
Yeah.
and your work and the work of your compatriots has been absolutely invaluable to teach the public. I never refer to you by name, always as the professor. I have done everything I could by talking to people, everything I legally could with money to see this day happen. I am absolutely overjoyed, not just, as I say, for your country, but for the planet.
Thank you so much,
Jim. Without this, we stood next to no chance.
Yeah, I share your feelings. Jan, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Arson in Armenia. Arson, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's a victory!
It's a victory! Yeah, I got it, Arson. So the Armenians like this too, eh?
Yes, yes, Tom. Thank you for your education for everyone around the world. I mean, you inspire everybody. I mean, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, we have a new hope, new change. And, you know, it gives me a lot of hope. You know, you won't believe how inspired I am.
Yeah, well, that's great. Arson, thank you so much for the call from Armenia, and thank you for listening to us. It is much appreciated. Yurik in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Hey, Yurik.
Hey, Tom. Let me tell you a story, man. I hope you can understand me. I was not born in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I was born in St. Lucia. I joined the United States military. I went to the Persian Gulf War, not being an American citizen. I heard Reagan talk about freedom, justice, and all those stuff. It made me so happy, you know, that people could have those ideals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, I felt like, you know, I've been to war, I guess. I perform post-traumatic stress and stuff, so I don't go out. And I felt all those ideals were lost. You know, I was questioning about myself and humanity, you know. Mm-hmm. And to finally see, you know, that Barack Obama won, it kind of gave me hope again, you know.
Yeah.
You don't know how happy I am just to hear that. I think I'm kind of like inspired right now, you know,
yeah.
to see that change. And at least humans are not actually as bad as I actually think we are. We
yes.
can be, rather.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's all I had to say, man.
Well, thank you so much, Yurik.
Yeah,
I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening to us in the U.S. Virgin Islands there. David in Copenhagen, Denmark. David, we have just a half a minute before we've got to wrap up the hour. Quick comment?
Okay, well, we had about 300 people, Tom, and when they broke the news there on CNN, oh, man, it was just wonderful. It was marvelous.
And
we had some Danish politicians. The American ambassador was there. He was a Republican, but he sent us some nice words, too. It was a great night, and we are so happy.
That's great. So the Danes are celebrating, too.
The Danes are celebrating. We did it for everybody. You know, I'm chair of Democrats Abroad Denmark here, but we did it for everybody, not just the Americans.
That's great. David, it's great to hear from you. It was wonderful meeting you back in March.
You're listening to the best of the Tom Hartman Program.
From all of us here at the Tom Hartman Program, a very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you do if your mortgage is upside down, underwater, basically, you know, owe more than your house is worth? What do you do if you can't make the payments? What do you do if you have an adjustable rate mortgage and you got it because the mortgage broker said, you know, the rate's going to be really low the first 2, 3, 4 years, and then it'll go up, but by that time you'll be able to easily refinance at a low rate again. And now you can't. Alan Jablonski is a consumer rights attorney and a licensed mortgage broker. He's the author of a new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, mortgage-maze.net, M-A-Z-E.net. Alan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
So what do people do in the situations that I described?
Well, the first thing they need to do is contact a HUD counseling service in their neighborhood. They can go to www.hud.gov and look up what counseling services are right in their specific neighborhood and go talk to these folks.
This is the Housing and Urban Development Department, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Do they actually run these counseling services, or do they license private corporations to do this?
They're licensed small businesses that basically HUD is paying them to be there for you.
So you don't have to pay for it?
There are no costs. That's a big red flag for folks. If you contact somebody who's advertising on the radio or television that says, we're going to modify your loan, but you call up and they want money up front, you're not talking to a HUD-approved counselor.
Right. So number one, go to HUD.gov, G-O-V, and find a HUD-approved credit counselor in your area. They will not charge you to talk to you.
Absolutely.
And make an appointment and go visit with them. Number two.
The next step is you can go to hopenow.com and speak with them. Although the problem is that the numbers that Hope Now has been putting out over the last year, as far as the people that they've helped, what they're saying they're doing and what they're actually doing, we don't see them meshing right now.
Who is HopeNow.com?
It was a program set up by the federal government to try to help distressed homeowners.
It's dot what?
HopeNow.com.
.com, okay. Huh. And this was set up by the federal government?
Yes.
Okay.
They've been stating over the last year that they've helped hundreds of thousands of people avoid foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But I have yet to talk to anyone that HopeNow.com has actually helped.
So you can try it out, but it may be another heck of a job, Brownie, Bush administration boondoggle.
Absolutely. With Secretary Paulson's comments yesterday, when they passed the $700 billion bailout bill, many of us knew right away, we knew 30 days ago that none of that money was going to help distressed homeowners.
Yeah. It was pretty predictable, and we're still seeing, all of these companies that are getting all this government money, paying huge salaries and compensation to their executives, and paying dividends to their stockholders, and on and on it goes. And now Henry Paulson is saying, well, we're not even going to use it to buy up distressed assets. We're going to use it instead to free credit. There is some reality to the fact that consolidated and resold consumer credit, whether it's home mortgages or whether it's credit card credit, is a market that is getting harder and harder for these companies to sell into. The Chinese are less and less interested. The Saudis less and less interested in buying those credit. And so the price on selling them, the premium on selling them is going up. So it's less profitable for the credit card companies and for the mortgage companies. And you can argue it'd be a good thing for the government to somehow make that market a little more liquid. But it seems to me like the best way to make that market more liquid would be to solve the problems on the ground in the United States so that the U.S. consumer is a more creditworthy core asset or core debtor or whatever you would call that, at the core of that debt instrument, that you've got somebody who can actually pay the bill, which has to do with, jobs and decent wages and long-term unemployment insurance and the things that are not that are going to help people not get thrown out of their homes.
Absolutely. Secretary Paulson, 40 days ago, when he sold this bill of good to the American people and to Congress, said, we're doing this to restore trust in the system. And he was basically lying at the time. No new facts have come up. He commented, there's new facts that popped up, so we're not going to help out the homeowners here. And he knew what he knew 40 days ago, and nothing's changed. People are still losing their homes. The foreclosure crisis continues to escalate. And, most of us out here are wondering why they're leaving the consumers. They're left on their own and left to their own devices. All of the programs that the banks are coming up with, there's a very narrow window that many people have to fit through to qualify for their programs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues is the stated income loans. When they stated their income, if they said they made $5,000 a month and they really made $4,000 a month, when you go in to modify your loan with your loan servicing company, you have to show, you have to document all your income. So you're actually giving the information to your lender that you may have committed fraud during the original loan process. Now, we who work in consumer rights and in the mortgage business know that 80% of that was done by the mortgage brokers and lenders.
In many cases, the borrowers didn't even know that these numbers were being put on their mortgage applications.
Absolutely. Who reads that stack of two-inch thick stack when the notary sits in front of you and says, sign
right.
here,
sign this, sign
here, sign
right.
here?
Let me just, if I may, Alan, in midstream here, toss this in. We're talking with Alan Jablonski. He's a consumer rights attorney and licensed California mortgage broker. If you have a question and you'd like to ask an actual consumer rights attorney and guy who knows this stuff, give us a call at 866-303-2270. Michael's going to clear the board of all our other calls for this. And you know, we'll continue this for a few minutes. Alan Jablonski's book is called Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, the website mortgage-maze.net. So anyhow, as you were saying, Alan.
Well, there is one voice of sanity coming out of Washington, and that's FDIC Chair Bears. She has been pushing to try to get the banks and loan servicers to modify these loans and actually forgive principal so that we can cut down on the foreclosure rate.
Hang on just a second, Alan. Okay. Stephanie, Michael is not answering the calls that are coming in on the board. If you could ask him to please grab those. Thank you. I'm sorry, Alan. Continue.
Okay.
And if somebody's calling and it just keeps ringing and ringing, just keep on ringing because we've got a new board, a new call screener, and he's taking a few minutes to get to it. Alan, continue.
She recognizes that we can either help the homeowners today or we can bail out all the banks tomorrow.
Right.
Because the same banks that are refusing to modify people's loans, whether it's an interest rate reduction or forgiveness or a forbearance of some of the principal load, if they don't do that, many of the banking institutions are going to be owned by the FDIC, just as IndyMac went by the wayside a few months ago.
Yeah, yeah. So... what is the potential for somebody if they go into their lender and say, you know, well, yeah, my loan form said that I made $5,000, or even, you know, there are some people who did say that they made $5,000 a month, perhaps with fraudulent intent, when in fact they only made $1,000 a month, thinking that they could buy a house, fix it up, flip it. I mean, we had TV shows called Flip This House, and if the lender would go along with it or even encourage it, they were committing fraud. Is there a possibility of prosecution?
There is that possibility, except that I believe that the FBI is flooded with going after the big fish right now. The problem that these folks are going to face is whether they were aware of the inflated numbers or not, is that they were the ones who signed under penalty of perjury on that loan application that this was their income.
Right.
And what it does is first, that loan servicer could rescind the contract and take the house right away, which they probably won't because there's too many foreclosures out there right now, but it's a possibility. Second, they could turn around and let's say that the homeowner lost their job and they need to go into bankruptcy court.
Mm-hmm.
You could lose your bankruptcy protection under Chapter 7 or 13 if fraud can be shown.
Ouch. We're talking with Alan Jablonski, his website, mortgage-maze.net, a consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker, author of the new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. We'll take your calls for Alan right after this break. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for a free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
You're not exactly who you are. It's time.
21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Alan Jablonski is with us. He is a consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker, the author of the new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, mortgage-maze.net. And, Alan, you want to take some calls?
Surely.
Okay, Ezekiel in Upton, California. You're on the air with Alan Jablonski.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Oh, good. Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. This is for Mr. Jablonski. I bought a home in 2006. It was for $385,000. It's been reappraised now at like $245,000, and I went into my lender.
Whoop.
Did we just lose him?
We just lost him, yeah. So what do you, you know, as much as we knew of that, what do you do if you go into your lender and they say, you know, well, whatever. I mean, what do you do if you've got a $300,000 mortgage on a house that's worth $250,000?
Well, it depends on what your financial situation is. I could never counsel anyone who can afford their current mortgage payments to walk away from the contract. You would be as irresponsible as the people on Wall Street and the lenders and brokers that got you into that loan in the first place. If you're facing...
Well, what's the, setting aside the issue of responsibility, of morality, what is the consequence of walking away from a mortgage?
Basically what they could do is they can turn around and sell your home, whether it's through a real estate agent or at auction, and you can be liable for the loss, the difference between what was owed and what that house sold for. Although there, as long as no fraud was committed during the process, bankruptcy would be available to you.
Right.
As a protection.
Otherwise, it's a lifetime of bill collectors. James in Phoenix, you're on the air with Alan Jablonski. Hey, James.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good.
Very good.
I had a quick question. I am not knowing what to do. My question is, me and my neighbor both buy a home at $300,000. Now, a year and a half later, these houses are worth $200,000. Now, my neighbor has kind of stopped paying payments because he can't afford it, and his house is going into foreclosure. Now, if he's able to renegotiate his loan with the bank and, you know, maybe get his principal down to $200,000 and renegotiate with the bank, and I'm, on the other hand, struggling but still being able to pay my payments, is there anything I can do rather than kind of, you know, go into foreclosure as to being able to speak to this bank?
Well, is your loan a fixed loan? Are you in a 30-year fixed?
I'm not. I'm in a 5-1 ARM.
Okay, then it's going to adjust out. It's going to go adjustable in the next couple of years.
Yes.
Then I would start talking to your bank now try to renegotiate and do a 30-year fixed right now. And during that process, argue with them that they should reduce your principal a little bit to assist you so that you can stay in your home. You have to let them know that there's a problem. This is the difficulty that most homeowners are facing, that with all the assistance that the banks claim that they're putting out there, you must fit into a very narrow window of being able to afford the house or whatever the renegotiated principal is and the payment rate, and then also being in distress right now. Most of them want you to be behind on your mortgage payments, which is a little late to start talking about a solution. They should be talking to people about getting a reasonable solution now before the problem goes into foreclosure, you know, 6 months.
So should James start going late on his mortgage payments in order to get the attention of his bank?
It's sad, but many of them are requiring that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would press them. Tell them that you're not going to be able to afford the payment once it adjusts. You want to address the problem right now. And I'll tell you what I've heard from a couple of my clients that we've spoke to in the past. Get the CEO's name and number of whatever bank it is. Send them a letter. Tell them if you're not getting any help with the people that you're talking to at the customer service level, and many people are getting the runaround, also go to a HUD counselor and talk to them. Tell them of your situation. They're not going to charge you to sit down and talk with them. And
yeah.
Then start approaching your bank and
right.
Work your way up.
Would everything apply the same way if, because when I got my loan, I got actually an 80-20 loan. So I do have two different loans. So would it apply the same way? I would just need to talk to both of these companies?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay. James, we got to move along here. Doris in Columbia, South Carolina. Quick question, Doris.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering while I was sitting here listening, what do you think the intention was originally of these lenders, knowing that these APR loans weren't going to be made? Do you think they wanted to get some of these houses so that they can make a profit, knowing that the consumer wasn't going to be able to afford it? Do you think that
Absolutely.
Was all?
No, I don't believe that was the reason. The reason for this is just pure greed. They wanted to show great profits over the last few years. I don't think even the banking industry understood the ramifications of this problem. We haven't seen the worst of it yet. These option arm loans are going to continue to recast over the next 3 to 4 years.
Right. Alan, can you stick around for another 10, 15 minutes, take a few more calls?
Sure can.
Great. We're talking with Alan Jablonski. His website, mortgage-maze.net, his book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, taking your calls at 866-303-2270. It's 27 minutes past the hour. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our free video stream. Stick around.
You're listening to the best of Tom Hartmann.
I'd want your job. I can barely handle the simple one I got. Hey, Mr. President, how cool is Air Force One? Are those guys in the House and the Senate ever gonna get anything done? I ain't no Democrat. I ain't no Republican. We're fathers and mothers, we're wives and husbands, and we pray that we dance at our daughters' weddings, and our sons grow to fine men, and for peace on our land. Hey, Mr. President.
Talk radio for the sane among us. An increasing majority. It's nice to know. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 35 minutes past the hour. We're talking with attorney Alan Jablonski of mortgage-maze.net. His website, his book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Alan, you still with us?
Sure am.
Okay, let's take some calls here. And to the callers, try to be short and punctual with your questions. And Alan will be short and punctual with his answers because we've got a whole board slam full of calls here. Linda in Hollywood, Florida. You're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Your question?
Good. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've been in my house since 94 and through a series of refinancing for various reasons, wound up with a very high payment and just, I've always paid, but in the last 3 months have been unable to. I've been talking with the mortgage company. Last week I called them and tried to make one payment. They told me they couldn't accept the one. They needed two, which I couldn't do at the time. And, I want to stay in my house. The value of the house has gone down over $100,000 in the last year. I would like to just know what I could possibly do.
The first thing you should do is contact a HUD counselor. Go to HUD.gov and find a counselor in your neighborhood. It's very difficult for an individual to try to renegotiate their loans with their lender without some assistance. Now, what I also suggest, and people have to be very careful about this, as a mortgage broker, I've seen all the emails going around in the mortgage brokerage area. The mortgage brokers are trying to get in on the loan modification business. So the very people who helped create the problem are now stepping in saying they can help you. They have no fiduciary duty to their clients. So if you can't get help through HUD or Hope Now, then the next step is to talk to an attorney in your area who may be able to help.
to help Linda?
Thank you for that, because I was contacted actually by a company who did this recent appraisal, and I've been calling them now the last week, and, you know, I haven't been getting callback, and they were the ones who told me that I need to be current on my mortgage in order for them to work any kind of deal.
Don't trust any company that calls you. We're getting all kinds of emails from people saying, hey, I got a call from this company. They're claiming they can help me. Initiate the phone call with a HUD-approved counselor or an attorney, period.
Right. If they're trying to sell you services, forget it. Gray in Alma, Georgia. Hey, Gray, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jablonski. I've got a problem with my mortgage. I have recently tried to figure out a way to make my payment, and it's in the process of going before public auction for foreclosure. Is there any way to salvage any kind of relationship to fix my problem?
When's your auction going to take place?
It's supposed to go in the 1st of December.
You need to get on the phone with your bank right now. This morning, this afternoon, you need to go down, find a HUD-approved counselor, go on the Internet. You'll see a little counseling services. Click on that button there, put in your city and state, and find a counselor and get down there today. It may or may not be too late for you, sir.
Okay, good luck, Gray, on that. Good luck. Tom in Seattle. Hey, Tom, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hey, Alan. I'm calling. There are a lot of people that are already in bankruptcy, and I noticed that these new bailout procedures exempt people that are in Chapter 13 bankruptcy already, and those people are just really getting the shaft on this, because they can't even participate, and they did the Chapter 13 bankruptcy just to protect their home anyway. Is there anything happening on that realm for people that are already in Chapter 13 bankruptcy?
There is no law that has been passed this year, no federal law that's been passed this year that does anything to protect homeowners. The Foreclosure Prevention Act, the Stimulus Act, the bailout, all of them have the same language that has been enacted through the Truth in Lending Act, et cetera.
It's all about protecting bankers and not bankees.
The government has been protecting the financial institutions over the last year and not the homeowners.
Right.
Another
call to make might be to your state representative, your federal representative, your U.S. member of the House of Representatives, or your two U.S. senators to say, you know, I got this problem. I want you to do something about it. I realize you can't help me personally, but you can introduce legislation that will help all of us.
Absolutely. And I have suggested this to people in the past. Call your state assemblyman. Call your state senator. Call your congressman or congresswoman, your state senator. Tell them, you know, you've been hearing about all that they've been doing for you. I want you to help me with my bank and see, you know, most offices have liaisons that deal with problems for their constituents.
Right. So sometimes maybe even they'll contact the bank. That's an interesting one. Alan Jablonski is with us. Dan in Phoenix, you're on the air with Alan.
Yeah, hi. I have a similar problem as James, which was your first caller. Almost verbatim the financial situation. However, my situation is aggravated by two specific things. One of which is we bought our home from a new home builder who stuck us in a crappy mortgage in lieu for, you know, getting some upgrades, and we refinanced out of that mortgage in January of 2007 into a 5/1 ARM interest only. Since then, our values declined about 30%. I'm very well aware of where it is because I'm in the industry, and that's one problem that I've heard people having is not being able to work with the banks because they refinance their mortgage. Well, we didn't pull any cash out. We did an 80-20, and you know, basically, you know, we afford our mortgage currently. It's tough, but, you know, at this point, I mean, you know, because I'm in the industry, my income's gone down substantially, so has my wife's, and we're wondering what I can do about that problem. And secondly, We also own investment property, which fortunately are doing okay, but we're also learning that you have to qualify for the payments of the investment properties without the income.
Hmm.
It is, you know, you're facing an uphill battle. It's much easier for people who had their purchase money mortgages that didn't refinance, that can talk with their lenders. Although I've got to tell you, across the board, the lenders are not doing what they're telling the public they're doing. There's no one out there that is watching the numbers. You know, you have Citibank come out and say, well, we've got this new program. Well, I want to see the numbers. I want to hear who they're helping.
Yeah.
And I'd like somebody to email me that they got their principal reduced through some kind of modification or workout. They can send me an email at alan@ajconsumerwatch.com. I want to hear what I have yet to hear. One person who got a principal reduction.
Well, we had a VP of Citibank on either yesterday or the day before, and that was the day that they rolled this thing out. So maybe it's just beginning, or maybe they're just blowing smoke at us.
Bank of America and Chase have all talked about programs that over the last couple of months that they were on board with helping people. And I have yet to hear anything about a principal reduction.
Okay. We need the power of government to come down on these guys' heads hard. Dan, thank you for the call. Steve in Discovery Bay, California. You're on with Alan Jablonski.
Thanks for taking my call. Discovery Bay is about 10 miles from Mountain House, which you mentioned the other day.
It's a community where 90% of the houses are upside down.
That's correct. And the cancer has obviously spread to the neighboring communities, including my own. I bought my house for $380,000 6 years ago. A comparable house around the corner was bank-owned for a year and boarded up and sold last month for $200,000. There's a boarded-up house on every block of our neighborhood, and people are walking away. There's foreclosure fires, you know, people burning their houses down to try to get insurance money, which is, you know, criminal and horrible, but it's happening.
Steve, we have 30 seconds. You have a question for
the math? I've done the math. No, there's almost no way to benefit by continuing paying this mortgage. People are renting houses for $1,000 a month, but should I walk away? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, I could never counsel anybody to, on an individual basis, to be act like these gentlemen on Wall Street have acted over the last few years. But I can't deny the economic sense. If I was $300,000 upside down in my house, would it make economic sense to walk away? Yeah, probably.
Alan, in the next segment, we're going to bring on an advertiser for a very short 2-minute segment to talk about their success advertising. And if you can stick around, we can pick up a couple more calls after that.
Surely.
Great. Alan Jablonski, his website, mortgage-maze.net, his new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Stick around.
This is the best of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting your show, supporting our show, your radio station, and our advertisers. Let them know you're listening. And speaking of our advertisers, Steve Hsu is with us. He is the Marketing Communications Director of Independent Power Systems. We regularly put on our advertisers for a very short 2-minute segment, 1 minute to talk about their product, give them a chance to pitch their product, and a tip of the hat to them and thank them for advertising on our local affiliates. Steve is advertising on KKZN in Denver. and also to talk about the success, and a second minute to talk about the success they're having with advertising and progressive talk radio. And then we'll be getting back to Alan Jablonski. Steve, welcome to the show.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. The website is Solar IPS, Independent Power Systems, solarips.com. Great website, by the way, Steve. Looks
Thank
like Independent Power Systems is doing great stuff there in Colorado. You want to tell us about it? Tell us about what you're doing, what your product is.
Well, Tom, in Colorado, we primarily do solar PV, which is photovoltaic systems. In Montana, where we also operate a branch, we do a lot more off-grid, so we combine wind and not off-grid solar. So in Colorado, we mainly do what's called grid-tied solar. So we put solar panels on your roof, and they connect to the power grid through a thing called an inverter. So the power that's made on your roof is actually converted to power that's usable by the grid by a piece of equipment called an inverter, and it has a thing called a net meter. So when you produce power, your meter actually spins backwards. So that's something that's really neat about solar electric. This is all made possible by something called Amendment 37, which is a people-powered initiative to change the Colorado Constitution to create a renewable energy portfolio for the state. And that mandates that Colorado will produce 20% of their energy through wind and solar power by 2020. So to go along with that, the investor-owned utilities here in Colorado have quite a substantial rebate of $350 a watt for solar systems. And that combined with the federal tax credit, which is uncapped, of 30%, that can wind up being about 60% of the total cost of a solar electric system.
So, wow, that's great. We're talking with Steve Hsu. He's the Marketing Communications Director for Independent Power Systems in Colorado and Montana, solarips.com. Steve, how's your results been advertising on KKZN in Denver?
Tom, the results have been amazing. I was so surprised. Our great account executive, Tanya Gates, told us that we might have to wait a while to get some results, but the phone started ringing almost immediately, and I'd say we're getting 5 to 10 calls a week since we started advertising with KKZN. So it's really awesome to be able to really target our audience. I mean, I know that people who are listening to KKZN are educated and interested in change and, you know, they're the perfect audience for our message and for our product. So it's been really amazing.
That's great. Steve, thanks so much for advertising and Progressive Talk Radio and for being with us today and for the great work you're doing, solarips.com. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Great talking with you. Alan Jablonski is back with us. And, Alan, in fact, I'm gonna nail Alan down on the other side. Alan, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Amy in San Diego, California has a question for you, Alan. Amy, you're on the air. Amy in San Diego? On the left side of the board? Nope. Not hearing anything from Amy. Let's see here. Ezekiel in Upland, California. Hey, Ezekiel.
Hi, Tom. Sorry we got disconnected. I think I'm over the Bermuda Triangle. Anyway,
okay. So what's up?
The bottom line was is that I had 100% financing, 30-year fixed, and I'm upside down on my mortgage. I went to my lender. And they basically said, why would we renegotiate anything with you? You're up on your payments, even though now you're struggling with costs and services of other items, you know, increasing. And you're not facing foreclosure. And it just occurs to me that, gee, I should have bought a $3 million home and then got into arrears, and they would work with me. And you guys just weigh in on that. What do you think?
Sure.
Well, if you got a 30-year fixed and you proved your income and you've been making your payments – odds are your lender is not going to work with you because all that could be done is lower the principal owed or lower your interest rate. I think that what a lot of people and what this caller is frustrated about is, why is everybody else getting helped that got themselves underwater and are being foreclosed on, where I've been responsible, I'm making my payments, and everybody else is getting help? I want to let this caller know everybody else is not getting help. The foreclosures are going through the roof. It is increasing exponentially over and will continue to do so into next year. If you're making your payments and you're happy with your home, stay with it. Whether I can't counsel people enough that your home is your home.
And the values will eventually come back.
Stop looking at it as an investment tool, and look at it as your home.
Yeah.
Now, if you get into a situation where you can't afford your payments,
then start talking to your lender.
And that's a whole different thing. And then you need to, like all these corporations coming to us with their hand out, you need to be too big to fail. Mike in Florida, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Guys, I tell you, I've got a $20,000 balloon that's going to come due in a year. Everything is current. Unfortunately, I'm upside down. What was selling for $280,000 a year ago just sold one in foreclosure for $85,000. You know, in a year, I'm not going to be able to handle that $20,000 balloon with no equity.
Is your credit good right now?
Actually, my credit just changed. I couldn't believe it. It went from 644 to 559 in 1 month with no changes in my credit account.
Okay, well, there must be something. You can go to annualcreditreport.com and get all three of your credit reports for free. You're allowed to do that once per year. Take a look and see the negative. You've got to have negative information to be in the 500.
I would have agreed, Alan, but, I mean, I just got a report. I have a monitoring service.
Okay.
I just got a report that said no changes.
Okay, well, you need to check it yourself. Basically, if with that situation, go to a head counselor. Start talking to them now. Don't wait until next year.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. Yeah, that seems to be the bottom line. Is you can go to HUD.gov, Housing and Urban Development, HUD.gov, and check it out. And, of course, Alan Jablonski's book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, mortgage-maze.net. Thank you, Alan.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to the best of the Tom Hartman Program.
From all of us here at the Tom Hartman Program, a very happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it was one of those truly dramatic moments this morning at the White House. George Bush came out and announced that he was going to pardon a turkey as the turkey handler started walking a large white bird down the aisle. Scooter Libby came running out, pushed the bird aside, and jumped up on the table. Our quote for the day, greetings, my friends. Our quote for the day from Jon Stewart of The Daily Show. He says, I celebrated Thanksgiving in an old-fashioned way. I invited everyone in my neighborhood to my house. We had an enormous feast, and then I killed them and took their land. Our guest to stare it out. What are you thankful for today? Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. I am thankful for my family. I am thankful for my parents who gave me life and those who preceded them. I'm thankful for this extraordinary nation and the people who have fought and died for it all these years. I'm thankful for the Enlightenment that birthed it. I'm thankful for my children. I'm thankful for the great people here in Portland, at Clear Channel, and in New York City at Air America, who helped make this program possible. I'm thankful for so much. And we'll get into what you're thankful for, too, as the day goes on at 866-303-2270. In our second hour, by the way, Scott Horton, the contributing editor of Harper's Magazine, is going to be with us. He's thankful that there's a possibility that the criminals in the Bush administration might get prosecuted after the 21st of January, and he will be telling us who and how and why. And in our third hour, Jeff Golden's going to drop by for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. He has a new novel out, Unafraid. What would have happened if John Kennedy had never been assassinated? It should be an interesting day. And Larry Scott with our VA Watchdog segment for the week, the veterans segment. But right now, Ken Davis is with us, Kenneth Davis. He is the author of so many wonderful books, one of my favorite historians, Kenneth C. Davis. His website, don'tknowmuch.com. It's the Don't Know Much series. Don't know much about the Bible, don't know much about the Civil War, don't know much about geography, don't know much about history, which is just a wonderful starting point. Don't know much about mythology, don't know much about anything, and his newest, Don't Know Much About Anything Else. Kenneth Davis, don'tknowmuch.com. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and always a pleasure, and thank you for having me, so I'm thankful for that.
Oh,
it's always
great.
A pleasure, Tom.
Thank you, Ken. Let's just go through some of the myths and realities about Thanksgiving.
I have to ask you first. One turkey always gets pardoned, but what about the other turkeys? I mean, it just means that somebody else gets, you know, has to take his place.
Well, we saw
like
that.
They're all.
We saw that the day before yesterday with Sarah Palin. I don't know
that's,
if you saw.
That's, That's right, with the scene that looked like it came from Fargo.
Yeah, I know. It was like kind of a bad Kafka movie. If they ever made a movie out of Kafka, I don't know, but it reminded me of The Prisoner, you know. Anyway.
What can I tell you about these turkeys?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, let's just go through some of these common thoughts and beliefs about Thanksgiving. The pilgrims, they always wore stiff black clothes and shoes with silver buckles.
Well, that was kind of the way they were depicted by the late 19th century when artists kind of started to idealize them. And it really was more of an image of the Puritans who come a little bit later in Massachusetts history. And we can sort out the difference between a Puritan and a pilgrim in a minute if you like. But no, the pilgrims who came on the Mayflower were very simple farming people that they would have worn what farmers in 1620 wore, which was colored clothes that were, you know, browns and reds and purples. And very simple things. That very stylized black somber with the formal hat really is what the Puritans looked like. And of course, the Puritans followed the Pilgrims to Massachusetts a little bit later, and then they took over.
Now, there was a period in British history where a theocracy was installed for, you would know, my recollection is it was 7 years, Cromwell. Following that theocracy, the people associated with him, who, as I recall, were the Puritans, and I may have this all wrong. I mean, it's been a lot of years since I studied British history. But isn't there a relationship between the British, as it were, revolution or civil war or overthrow of Cromwell and all that, the British experiment with theocracy and the people who came to the United States?
Sure. It is connected, and it really goes back to the importance of the religious wars over the Protestant Reformation that aren't just in England. In fact, I write about the people who came to America as the real first pilgrims 50 years before the Mayflower sailed. They were French Protestants. They came to America and landed in Florida. They had the good sense to go to Florida in June instead of Massachusetts in December. And this was 50 years before the Mayflower sailed, but they came for the same reasons, to escape the religious bloodshed in France at that time. When the Spanish learn that the French Protestants are there, however, they send a fleet over and wipe them out. And the admiral who kills these French Protestants hangs a sign over them that says, "I do this not as Frenchmen, but as to heretics." So this whole period is really a period of tremendous religious warfare. And that's part of the story of the birth of America. And what story is more important for our times? Actually, have a piece on the New York Times op-ed page about those first pilgrims today. And it's one of those stories that got completely left out of our history books.
Well, my recollection is that they seriously contaminated and for some time ran Massachusetts, that these were the people who had been basically run out of England because they were theocrats, and that Franklin left Massachusetts.
Yeah, we should.
Because he wanted to avoid these people. I mean, they were still, you know, Mary, what was her name, in the late 1600s, was the last woman to be hanged or burned or whatever as a witch in Massachusetts? Hanged, I think it was?
Well, we should go back to another Mary. The daughter of King Henry VIII is Mary, and she, unlike her father, was a devout Catholic and tried, and this is, again, this whole period of fighting over religion in England, she tried to bring Catholicism back to England and put a lot of Protestants to death for it, and that's the reason that she was known as Bloody Mary. Her half-sister then succeeded her, Elizabeth. Elizabeth came to the throne and was a Protestant herself and far more tolerant. Of course, Philip in Spain had married Mary. He wanted to marry Elizabeth after Mary died, and Elizabeth said no. So Philip said, "Well, if I can't marry her, I'll kill her." And so you had this tremendous period of warfare going on.
Was this Elizabeth the First around 1600?
That's Elizabeth the First, is the half sister of Mary, and Philip, who had married Mary, and you know, this is this incredible tangle of the European courts at that time.
Yeah.
But this is the whole background to these people wanting to leave England, the people we call the pilgrims, they did not think that the Church of England, which had broken away from Catholicism, had gone far enough. They wanted to completely separate from it. They were separatists, and that's why they really got kicked out of England first, went to Holland, weren't happy there, and then they get this opportunity to come to America. Now, only half of the people who are on the Mayflower fall into that category of what we would think of as pilgrims, people coming for religious freedom. The other half were people who were courted by the stock owners of the Mayflower to come over and start this new settlement. This was actually early American venture capitalism. There was money behind the Mayflower venture, and it was supposed to turn a profit. And so half of the people are pilgrims or saints, as they called themselves, and the other half of the 102 passengers are strangers, simply people who were coming for an opportunity to get some land in the New World.
Right. Now, the famous Jonestown colony of, what was it, 1607?
Is that 1607 is Jamestown, that's right.
It that vanished.
Has already been a step.
Now, there's been a lot of speculation over the years that they assimilated in with the Indians rather than simply starved. Any recent data on this?
Well, there's you might be sort of mixing.
Or am I mixing that up with something else?
Yeah, there was an earlier colony that was settled in what is now North Carolina. They're famously known as the Lost Colony,
right?
Or
that's what
Walter
I'm thinking
Raleigh
of.
Had
okay.
started it. They disappeared, they were supposed to get a relief ship to come and help them out. They disappeared. There's only a carved word on a tree that said Croatoan, and there's always been speculation that they did move on and mix in with local native groups, and many people in that area of North Carolina still claim that the colonists of the Lost Colony. In 1607, you get a different story. That's John Smith coming to Jamestown, and Pocahontas story. Again, tremendous story of how these people came to America, struggled with the help of the Indians, survived, but very soon after that were at war with them.
Let's dig just a little bit deeper, if we may, Ken Davis, after the break. Can you stick around?
Okay.
Ken Davis, don'tknowmuch.com is the website. One of our favorite historians on this day before Thanksgiving. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour, the day before Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? Tom Hartman here with you. And look out for shoppers carrying frozen turkeys. That's the message that Irene Mormon Bailey conveyed to poor Mr. Fred Lewis Irvin. Well, maybe not so poor. He stole some money from a gas station, ran across the street to a Harris Teeter store just south of Raleigh. Began beating up poor Irene while trying to steal her car. She grabbed a frozen turkey and beat this guy bad. The police had to take her off him and take him away. So there you go. Kenneth Davis is with us, the author of Don't Know Much About Fill in the Blank, his most recent book, Don't Know Much About Anything Else, and Don't Know Much About History, a great book. Ken, first of all, let's clean up maybe some of my British history illiteracy, because I don't claim to be a scholar of British history. Was the Cromwellian period, tell me, when was the brief flirtation with theocracy in England, or did I just manufacture that in my own brain?
No, not at all. But it does play into this whole story that we're talking about, the period where the Protestants and Catholics and the Church of England, which was closer to Catholicism at that time than we think of it today, were battling for supremacy in these mid 1600s. Cromwell's protectorate, as it was known, meant that the shoe was on the other foot for a while in England, and so the people who had once been loyal to the Church of England, they got pushed out, and instead of going to Massachusetts, they went to Virginia. For instance, George Washington's relatives were loyalists, and this is the whole period known as the Cavaliers versus the Roundheads. The Cavaliers were the people loyal to the crown. The Roundheads were more of the Protestants, and we're talking about an English Civil War that where Cromwell ruled until about 1653. So,
was he a Catholic?
1649. Pardon?
Was he Catholic?
Was who Catholic?
Was Cromwell Catholic?
No, he was Protestant.
But not Church of England Protestant.
That's right.
Oh, interesting.
That's right.
So where did the Puritans come from out of this?
Well, the Puritans were people who were loyal to the Church of England, but didn't think that the Church of England had gone far enough in moving away from Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And they run into trouble when King James I, for whom the King James Bible is named, comes into power. And although he didn't really try and bring Catholicism back, they were trying to move the Church of England back towards a more Catholic position. So it's a little confusing, I know, but again, it's you know, people fighting and dying and killing each other over their beliefs, and these are obviously Englishmen. And this is why in the late 1620s into 1630, about 20,000 Puritans start to leave England because they're really not welcome there under King James. They are being pushed out, and this great Puritan migration begins. About 20,000 people, and this was when Massachusetts really exploded in population, where New England really started to grow rapidly, starting in 1630 when Governor Bradford comes over with the Arabella.
Yeah, Bradford of the Shining City on the Hill speech, was he not?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. And the first Thanksgiving, this was just a regular harvest feast that the Indians had, was it not?
It really was a harvest feast to a pilgrim. Certainly at that time, a day of Thanksgiving would have meant something very different, and to the Puritans as well, would have meant a day of fasting and prayer. Now, some of us will be praying tomorrow, but there won't be a lot of fasting going on. What they were celebrating, obviously, in 1621 was, first of all, that they had survived. Half of the 102 Mayflower passengers, the settlers, died in that first year. It's astonishing attrition rates. 18 adult women were on the Mayflower. Only 4 of them were alive on that first Thanksgiving day, which probably happened in October, not November. In fact, Canada's Thanksgiving Day is in October, more appropriately to at least in terms of the pilgrims. The November date came about because Abraham Lincoln proclaimed this a holiday in 1863, and he made it the last Thursday in November. This was a holiday that a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale had been lobbying for about 30 years. She was a magazine editor, a magazine of its time called Lady Godey's Book, a kind of good housekeeping of its day. So I guess old Sarah Josepha Hale was the Martha Stewart of her time. And she had really kept up this drumbeat for a national holiday to honor the pilgrims and to honor the beginnings of America. And Abraham Lincoln finally pronounces it in November of 1863.
We have just a half a minute left, Ken Davis. How many Indians altogether, Native Americans, died as a consequence of this?
You know, that's a number that's very hotly debated. If we're talking about, you know, how many were in the two Americas when Columbus arrived in 1492, the numbers range up from, you know, 30 or 40 million to over 100 million. And the vast majority of those die mostly as a result of disease, smallpox in particular.
Smallpox and influenza. Ken Davis, Kenneth Davis, don'tknowmuch.com is his website. His books, Don't Know Much About History, the Civil War, Geography, or anything else. Ken, thank you so much.
The new one, America's Hidden History.
Oh, America's Hidden History. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. And I've just been handed this public service announcement to read to our listeners. Dear world, the United States of America, your quality supplier of the ideals of liberty and democracy, would like to apologize for its 2001 through 2008 service outage. The technical fault that led to this 8-year service interruption has been located, and the software responsible was replaced on Tuesday night, November 4th. Early tests of this newly installed program indicate that we are now operating correctly, and we expect it to be fully functional by January 21st, 2009. We apologize for any inconvenience caused by the outage, and we look forward to resuming full service, and hopefully even to improve it, in years to come. Thank you for your patience and your understanding. Signed, the United States of America. There you go. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States and around the world. And by the way, Sean's going to be picking out her favorite post today, totally arbitrary, in our chat room, which you can get to at tomhartman.com, and that person will receive an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So Colin in Pennsylvania. Hey, Colin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I really enjoyed your caller. I enjoyed your guest, because I'm an English history buff. I spent 18 years over there because my family's from there, and so I know a bit about it. And I just thought I could put it kind of in plain terms, the relationship between the Puritans and the English Civil War.
Great.
Basically, if you can imagine the different branches of Protestantism that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
All this was going on during the English Reformation, and there were lots of disagreements as to what direction that they would take as far as the Church of England was concerned. And you can imagine the Puritans as a very, very intolerant and fundamentalist kind of branch.
Mm-hmm.
They worshipped very much the way I would compare them to fundamentalists that we see in Muslim, because that's how rigid they were in their beliefs. And
or people like the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, the ones who mistakenly read the Bible, and they run around with signs that say God hates fags, when in fact what the Bible says is that God hates figs. Jesus withered two fig trees. They don't have it right. Anyway, yeah. So by the way, this is all post Henry VIII and also post Martin Luther, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And they weren't so much, they were persecuted, but they were more ridiculed than persecuted, especially in Elizabethan times. In Elizabethan times, they were very anti-Shakespeare. They didn't like the plays. They thought they were rude. And as far as the Civil War is concerned, the Civil War started out more as a power struggle between Parliament and the King. It went more theological because the guy who led the parliamentary forces, Oliver Cromwell, was a Puritan, and he did great damage over there while he was in power. He slaughtered thousands of people, not only in Ireland and Wales, but also in England itself. You know?
Yeah, my recollection was that was one of the reasons that the Puritans fled to the United States, was because after Cromwell, they were widely hated in England.
No, not really, because really Cromwell was on their side.
Right, but I mean after he was deposed or discredited.
Although
he's, you know, there's still a statue of him, you know, out in front of Parliament there, you know, Lord Protector Cromwell.
Well, you know what the Puritans did? They came over to America and burned all their women as witches, but over there they slaughtered thousands of non-believers and heretics, that they called them heretics and stuff. So
very bizarre time.
I'm
Colin,
not a
what are you
Puritan fan, so.
Yeah, there you go. Colin, what are you thankful for today?
What's that?
What are you thankful for today?
I'm not getting you very clearly, Tom. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. What are you thankful for today?
What am I thankful for today? I guess that I still have a reasonable job, and I am looking forward to spending time with my family. I guess that would be the most thing I'm thankful for is my family.
There you go.
And that I can still provide for them.
yep. Amen. Colin, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Ian in Sammamish, Washington?
Yes, Sammamish.
Sammamish. Okay.
Yeah.
Ian, what's up?
Right. Well, I was probably going to be slightly at odds with your last caller.
Okay.
As he said,
I would guess from your accent that you have a more intimate knowledge of this than I.
Yes, possibly. The whole at the beginning of the 1600s, there was the dispute between the Catholics and the Protestants.
Right.
And you had various monarchs who were leaning more back towards Catholicism.
Now, by Protestants, do you mean the Lutheran Protestants, or do you mean the Protestants who are following Henry VIII?
Various monarchs, I said, rather not Protestants. So you had James, Charles I was definitely heading the Church of England back towards Catholicism, and this was one of the things that brought up or led into the Civil War. There was also his taxation policies, which got somewhat creative. There was I think it was called the ship tax, which was levied on port towns so that they could fund the navy, and he sort of changed it so that anywhere within 100 miles of the sea was classed as a port town.
Right, now this is what I said, John the First?
That's the whole country, basically.
You said this was John the First?
That was Charles the First.
So this is the John who signed the Magna Carta?
No, sorry, Charles the First.
Oh, Charles the First. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. So we're a couple hundred years later.
Yeah.
400 years later.
So you then lead into the Civil War and the Cromwellian period.
Right.
Now, you know, there's this idea that the Puritans were the whole time beating up on other people. In fact, it was a period where there was quite a large religious tolerance. Cromwell actually was the first ruler in Britain to reopen synagogues for a number of hundred years. So there was, you know, rather than the Puritans holding power and dictating that everybody else should be a Puritan, there were many Protestant sects, there were other religions were allowed. The only people who were really persecuted were the Catholics.
Mm.
And as I say, because of the monarchy heading towards Catholicism, this was part of the reason for the Civil War.
Yeah.
Cromwell reigned until 1658 when he died, and then for a short period his son took over as ruler, and then in 1660 Charles II was returned to the throne.
Right.
And like many events, a lot of the history that we have of the initial sources are those written by those who won the eventual argument. So a lot of the early accounts of what happened in the 1650s under Cromwell were heavily flavored by the royalists once they got into power. And it's really
to make Cromwell look bad.
I'm saying he's not as black as he painted.
Yeah.
And there are a number of modern British historians who have sort of been looking back at this. The name that springs to mind is a fellow called Christopher Hill, who's one of the books I did at university on this.
Right.
But, you know, it's a classic case of, you know, the victors write the history.
Yeah, so this is, you know, much like there's still an ongoing and active debate in Germany over whether Marius van der Lubbe, the guy who torched the Parliament building in 1932, was it, or 33, February 28th, as I recall.
Yeah, 33. Yeah,
whether he was working with the Nazis or whether he was just a demented Dutchman.
Yeah.
And there's a new history book out claiming that, no, he wasn't working with the Nazis. If he were, they would have gotten more of the artwork out of the building before it burned down.
Yeah.
In any case, we're still debating history here now 500 years later.
Yeah.
Or the British are. Fascinating. Ian, what are you thankful for today?
Getting to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much. Ian, thanks a lot for the call. Moving along here. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show. What are you thankful for today?
Oh, you've got all kinds of things, Tom. Too many to list. But I want to respond briefly to that cable from the United States of America apologizing for the power outage of the democracy outage of the last 8 years.
Right.
Well, you know, I thought that was a funny bit, but I would say that most of the United States history was a democracy outage as regards the rest of the world. I mean, if you look at all the imperialism and...
Yeah, we've had our bad times, Steve. I'll grant you that. But
yeah, I hear this notion
this was particularly bad.
Understanding as a moral leader over the last 8 years, but I would ask, when has the United States really been a moral leader? Maybe during World War II? But, you know, look at all the situation as regards Latin America all throughout the 20th century, the Southeast Asian conflict.
Steve, I recommend that you go back and read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. He came over here in 1836 and spent 6 months traveling around the country, went back and wrote what became the best-selling book for the first 50 years of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And it inspired entire nations to become democratic after our Civil War, after they realized that we weren't going to fall apart and tear ourselves apart.
That was a long time ago, though.
It was. But my point is that I would say that literally, from our inception, we have been an inspiration to the rest of the world. I absolutely agree we have imperfectly acted out democracy, small d democracy, in many ways, but we get better all the time. And the last 8 years have been an aberration in that regard because we went backwards. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our number.
This is the best of the Tom Hartman Program.
You're a chicken, and I'm a turkey, and here is my love song just to you.
Oh.
I love your wings, I love your beak, you do those things, they're so unique. I love your eyes, the way you walk, I love your voice. The way you squawk, I'm so alone and blue.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and our crazy alert for the day. Yeah, this is pretty amazing. I'll tell you, running over yourself while drunk driving. Yes, you heard it right. A 21-year-old man was spotted by the police, and they chased him into a ditch and through a barbed wire fence before stopping. He opened the door, thought he put the truck in a park, but actually put it in reverse, and as he fell out of the open door, the car went into reverse, or the pickup truck, and the left front wheel ran over both his legs. Not real right. Something about the Darwin Awards there might be appropriate. I don't know. Michael in Templeton, California. Michael, what are you thankful for today?
My family mainly, and the imminent departure of the criminal regime that's been in power for 8 years.
Amen.
I wanted to clear something up first. Cromwell was 1646 to 1653, and of course the Puritans were already here, a lot of them.
Now, okay.
Now, Mr. Davis said something interesting that resonates with me. He said that there were 20,000 Puritans that emigrated from 1630 on. I have ancestors that came here in 1638 from England, and they came as part of a church group. They all emigrated all together.
Mm-hmm.
And there was these two brothers that I'm descended from by the name of Peck, and I did some research on this years ago, and they originated in a town north of Manchester, Weldon, Weedon, something like that. But the name goes all the way back to the 11th century. And then they left from a port in the eastern part of England called Hines, and then they came over and landed in Hingham, Massachusetts. And then 3 years later, I guess it was after King Philip's War, they went to Rhode Island and started a town that's still there. It's called Bristol, Rhode Island. And so now Mr. Davis gives me some context that I didn't really have before, that maybe these people that I'm descended from, they came as part of this Puritan immigration that he's talking about that started in 1630, because these people came here in 1638.
Could be.
I thought that was
great. And, you know, looking back at that time, I mean, thank you, Michael, for the call. And I just want to riff a little bit. This is actually from my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And the first Indian War in New England was the Pequot War of 1636, in which the colonists surrounded, this is, you know, back in the time of the first Thanksgiving, more or less, a little before that, I guess, but in which the colonists surrounded the largest of the Pequot villages, set it afire as the sun began to rise, and then performed their duty. They shot everybody, men, women, children, and the elderly, who tried to escape. As Puritan colonist William Bradford, yes, the William Bradford of the Shining City on the Hill speech, as Puritan colonist William Bradford described the scene, quote, "It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire and the streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and the colonists gave praise thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully." The Narragansetts, another tribe who typically had competed somewhat with the Pequots, up to that point had been friends of the colonists. They were so shocked by this particular example of European-style warfare that they refused further alliances with the whites. Captain John Underhill ridiculed the Narragansetts for their unwillingness to engage in genocide, and this is a quote from John Underhill in 1636. He said, quote, "Narragansett wars with other tribes are more for pastime than to conquer and subdue enemies," end quote. And in that, by the way, Underhill was correct. The Narragansett form of war, like that of most indigenous older culture people and almost all Native American tribes, did not have extermination of the opposition as a goal. After all, the neighbors are necessary to trade with, to maintain a strong gene pool through intermarriage, and to ensure cultural diversity. Most tribes wouldn't even want the lands of others, because they'd have concerns about violating or entering the sacred or spirit-filled areas of other tribes. Even the killing of enemies is most often not the goal of tribal, so what we refer to as tribal wars. It's most often to fight to some predetermined measure of victory, such as seizing a staff, crossing a particular line, or the first wounding of the opponent. Not killing. To count coup in most Indian wars meant to draw the first blood, not to kill. It could just be a scratch. And that person was out, and you got a feather. Jonathan in New York City. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, Mike, how are you? Tom, I've been listening to you for a long time listener. I just wanted to call in. I saw a special the other day, if I give 30 seconds real quick. I saw a special on the Nazis raiding art of Europe when they were going into other countries and killing folks and trying to wipe out their civilization, all vestiges of their civilization. I'll start by saying I'm a patriot. First and foremost, I'm an African-American. I believe in the ideals of this country. But I've been listening for so long. This professor went on to recount how, you know, the stealing of all the art, a Jewish professor, he was talking about the stealing of all the art, and how this was the worst group of mass murderers in history. So I went out, I did a little homework, and, you know, you do the standard homework on how many Jews were killed during the Holocaust, and then I just happened to look into African Americans. I found estimates up to 18 million people during the Atlantic slave trade. Sure. The Jewish professor was commenting. He was saying that never before in history have you had this kind of barbarism. He completely glossed over the entire thing in terms of, I understand it's pertinent to his experience, but this country, you know, he said, how can...
Well, hang on just a second here, Jonathan. I think that we all get it, that, you know, 18 million African-Americans killed as a consequence of the slave trade, a terrible thing. 100 million Native Americans killed as the result of the colonization of North America. Arguably, the latter had to do with the manifest destiny. It was government policy. Arguably, the slave trade was government policy. But the Nazis were just explicitly trying to eliminate an entire people from the face of the earth. So while the numbers don't necessarily line up, I think that there is an important difference in the goal there.
You're listening to the best of the Tom Hartman program.